This week we speak to the man who's surely created the defining illustrations of the Trump era, designing instantly iconic covers featuring the US president for Time magazine and Der Spiegel. Plus, the editor of an informative weekly for kids joins us, and from Scotland, a beautiful title focused on creativity that features some impeccable photography too. All that for you ahead today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis. I'm Tom Edwards. A packed show this week. Coming up, we speak with Anna Bassi, editor of the hugely successful weekly title for kids, The Week Junior, and Boom Saloon, a great new indie based in Edinburgh. But first, it's a real thrill to welcome to the programme the Cuban-American artist Adele Rodriguez. A former art director for Time magazine, these days he's better known for his iconic Trump covers for that title and also for German weekly Der Spiegel. These amazing pieces are fiercely political and, whilst rich in colour, fairly simmer with rage on the page. Quite possibly the defining images of the Trump era. And I'm delighted to welcome Adele Rodriguez to the programme. Hello, Adele. Thanks for being with us. Ed, I just wanted to ask you, first of all, it's an interesting time. A lot of people have talked about how impossible it is to satirise the unsatirizable. Of course, particularly if we talk about, you know, the Trump White House, for example. And yet your particularly covers you've done on some of the big global periodicals fly against that. They feel like the documents of our time. Is there something about illustration, its raw power maybe, that provide a counterpoint even to the ravings of someone like Donald Trump?
Yeah, I mean, I guess in some way I don't see it as funny or satire. So maybe that's why my work is a little stronger and captures that spirit, is that I at first glance, something might appear funny or grabs you in that way, but then there's a real deep anger and confrontation behind it. And I think that the one way you can oppose this insanity is to meet it with a lot of strength and force. And I think that's what I try to do with my images.
Well, to that point, I think in particular of Der Spiegel cover with Trump and the beheaded Statue of Liberty. Did you receive a lot of animus from that, from not just defenders of Trump, but from people who felt perhaps that was a step too far? Does that presumably make you proud about how impactful your work is?
Yeah, with that image, definitely there was a lot of reaction, a lot of commentary, probably the most about any of the images that I've made. And I think that, I don't know if it makes me proud, but it just makes me glad that people are noticing and paying attention to the topic. And it perhaps gets across the idea how serious this is, that maybe an artist would get to the point where they would make an image like that. So anything that makes people wake up and pay attention and get involved in what's happening is good to me. I think that's my main point, is just to get everyone involved. Because I think the biggest problem is that we start normalizing the situation and just think that putting little kids in cages and immigration camps is normal, or that the President of the United States would fire, you know, investigators, you know, things like that. If that stuff gets normalized, then we're basically in a new fascism. And I think that's my main concern. And I kind of see it to some degree already, where there are these things going on around us. Kids are being detained, or they're giving psychological or psychotropic drugs while we're all just going about shopping and going to the mall and things like that. So it's a very weird and surreal reality. And I think you do have to wake up people once in a while to go, wait, this is not normal. We should not normalize these kinds of things.
It speaks to the power of the brilliant illustrative image that I think a single cover can speak more even than the best headline, than the best piece of op-ed journalism. In some respects, I don't know, it just feels like the perfect riposte for our times. I wanted to ask you that a little bit about the beginnings of your work, if you like, as an illustrator. And I know you've talked about your background growing up in a country, you talk about the heavily saturated colour, and I always think that's really interesting. Did that cast you into looking at things with a particularly rich illustrator's eye from when you were, I don't know, from when you were a really small child, do you think?
If I look back and think back, definitely I saw things very directly and quickly and in a graphic way. I don't know if I might have picked that up when I was a kid or not, but it definitely, it's something that I try to do in my work, because I feel that's the strongest. You know, I'm basically trying to get people to understand an idea in 2-3 seconds. And I think that's the most direct way to do it is to be as rich and bold and powerful, colorful in imagery to get people's attentions. And going back to, you know, the idea of how an image can have more impact than, say, an op-ed or a whole writing or a story, I don't think people necessarily look at information the same way they used to. They don't sit down for an hour and say, I want to read this 10-page story on what's happening right now. You know, they're receiving things in bits and pieces from the web, from Twitter or whatever. And I think a lot of what they're reading and their understanding is in these quick ways. And I think that we may have to rethink how we communicate ideas to people, how we inform them. Anyone that has already voted for Trump or kind of likes him is not going to sit through a page article explaining the issues. But if they can't avoid an image popping up in their news feed for 2 seconds or 3 seconds and someone commenting on it or their friend, so it's, or even people that are in the middle, they really can't make up their minds. They're busy with work. They're not going to be reading these long-form articles. So these images really, I think, have a bigger impact sometimes in getting people to understand issues and ideas, I think.
And what about the mediums themselves? I find it quite interesting. Obviously, you graduated with honors in painting, I think, from Pratt Institute. You obviously use digital. You do line drawing, printmaking, all sorts of things. And the covers are, well, they're that. They're covers for paper magazines, but they have an amazing digital footprint. Are you thinking about their deployment across various different platforms? Do you sort of see them in your illustrator's eye as being on magazines or newsstand, for example? Does it not matter how you look at them initially?
I really look at imagery the same way, whatever format it's in. I really look at it as you're 20 feet away from something and I want to bring you in those 20 feet to get closer to what I just did. So if it's a poster on a street and it's very graphic and see it from far away, if it's about 2 inches on your phone, if it's on a magazine cover and you're at the bus station, it's this idea to communicate and get an audience's attention that is kind of going about their day, but it breaks through. I mean, I've seen my magazine covers on a newsstand with about 20 other magazines that are full of pop, fashion-y singers and high-gloss photos and things like that. And these covers, they just pop out in the newsstands and they pop out on the web with all that's happening. So I think that definitely goes across all mediums. And it's something that I thought about when I started. And even when I started, the idea of creating some sort of image or brand that would communicate very quickly with people is something that I thought about right at the beginning of this, probably like 2 years ago, that I really wanted a bit of repetition. When the image pops up, you immediately recognize the face and who you're talking about. And then you get into the concept or the idea and you read it within a few seconds. And that's something that creating a brand and then doing every, you know, once people recognize the brand, then you can do anything to it to destroy the brand, stretch it, you know, make an impact on it. So that's basically what I've tried to do probably since the primaries.
And does that inform at all the relationship that you have with the editors at some of these places? I'm thinking about the editorial teams at Time, at Der Spiegel. Is there a kind of a shorthand now between you and they? And do you think that your own training, obviously for a long time you were an art director, weren't you, from a prodigiously youthful age, in fact. Did your experience on that other side of magazines, do you think that, again, helps to inform the way you communicate with the people who are commissioning this work?
Yeah, I was an art director for 13 years, so I sort of understood how the whole industry kind of works. And you know, I was trying to figure out, how do I get this imagery to get published, to get out there and be on these covers? Because I think it is difficult to, you know, I can have my opinion, I can do whatever, but to have a company and a whole magazine and put it on the cover and then go out and defend it on Sunday news shows or whatever, that was a whole other step that I had to figure out how to do that. And I've done what I've done, but they've had the courage and guts to put this on the cover and go out and defend it fully. Both Time and Der Spiegel, their editors have gone on TV and they've taken a lot of heat for these things. And they say, no, we have the right to do this and this is how we feel. I didn't want the story at this time to be treated like we've treated magazine stories in the past. So let's say during the Iraq War, we took both sides. Journalism has this even-handed approach where you present the one side and you present the other. And I pretty much thought, there is no other side to this. This is just a horrible situation, very bad guy, and you cannot do that. So even before I was on the magazine covers, I was on the internet probably about a year before my first cover, putting these ideas out there and my work's followed by a lot of people in the industry. So it sort of fed into people's mindsets that maybe this is the way we should cover this. And it wasn't about a year after that I got my first cover, and it was the art directors that I've worked with in the past go, hey, we like what you're doing. We want you to do something on the current topic, which was the first Meltdown cover. The idea is kind of brewed from them seeing my work on the internet for a while and then seeing that it had a following and seeing that a lot of people were really behind it. And then it sort of gives them that little nudge of approval where let's go for it, let's put on the cover. But that works over time, and I understand how that stuff works.
What about the man himself? We talk about Donald Trump, because there's a lot of examples of people who are lampooned or satirized or caricatured or simply attacked in illustrated form. We have our satirical title Private Eye here, and it turns out that many politicians who are lampooned absolutely ferociously collect the covers, and they actually rather like the depictions. Do you have any evidence, anecdotal or otherwise, about, do you think that he looks at them? What do you think he thinks?
No, I think there is something to be said that he never mentions them. That's a really good thing.
Because it must annoy him terribly, no?
Yeah, because in America, being on the cover of Time magazine is like every billionaire's dream, you know? So, hey, you're on the cover of Time magazine, but, oh, you're melting. Or, oh, you're this, you're that. So I think that probably does get under his skin because he would love to show off this stuff. The only one that was mentioned once was by his son, Don Jr. He posted it online. It was an image that I made of three like demolition balls destroying Washington, and then each ball was Trump's head, and he said that that's exactly what we're doing to Washington, Time got it right or something like that. So I thought that was weird. You know, your father looked like an idiot as a ball, and you're saying that you're happy with the cover because that's what we're doing to the country, and someone that's proud to be destroying the country is kind of weird to me.
Brucey, yeah. I did start by talking about beyond satire. I know you questioned my initial sort of hypothesis, but there's something almost, yeah, Alice in Wonderland weird circularity about it, isn't there, when you can wind up that way. To that point, though, Adele, do you have a favourite? Is there a cover or a piece of work recently you've done that you feel was perfect, whether it was the perfect answer to a commission or perfectly captured the times or just perfectly captured a thought that you'd had? Is there, maybe it's like asking people to choose their favorite child, but do you have something that for you feels like the embodiment?
Well, I think, you know, if I had to pick a favorite image, it would be that one of the beheading of the Statue of Liberty, because it's so wrong and so disturbing, and it just hits people on so many different levels. But at the same time, it's so right that it gets at the crux of what we're talking about here. I'm an immigrant, and to me, the Statue of Liberty, you know, when I came to New York, is the first thing that I wanted to see. It really meant a lot to me. It means a lot to my family. I was working with something that meant a lot to me. So I would probably say that one.
You've mentioned already your own immigrant story briefly, and it's the classic example of an American success story built on the back of that. We like to try and always strike an upbeat note at Monocle and look for paths of optimism. It can be hard when talking about Trump and the direction politically that the UK, the US is going, across Western Europe as well, the Western world. We're seeing so many of these problems. Are you still a fundamentally an optimistic person? I'm looking for some rays of light here, Ed, or can you share any with us?
I think that what's happening worldwide is really an old generation trying to grab on to what it's had its entire life for 60 years or so. There's been people that are winners and losers and people at the top. And then now we have immigrants and many other people that want to be a part of this, and people feel challenged. The positive side that I see is almost every country that I go to that has difficulties, the young generation, people that are in their 20s or 30s, do not see any of this stuff. They're blind to all this animosity. You know, I've been in Russia, and the older generation is very stuck in their ways, and then the 20-year-olds are awesome. They're great. They're very welcoming in London and England and in the U.S. In the U.S., you have teens and 20-somethings that they see no difference in sexuality and race, little kids, and sometimes they don't even realize that someone is black. You know, that's just Tim or whatever. That's the hope, is that hopefully with 20 or 30 years' time, we'll be able to kind of erase a lot of this stuff. But what's happening is there's this final hanging on to something by people. And I think it's going to take a good 20 or 30 years to get past it.
Well, there's some cloudy stuff there, but there's a bit of optimism at the heart. Edo, it's great to speak with you. Thanks so much for your time.
Mm-hmm.
Let's move on now to the children's magazine market. The Week Junior is, as the name hints fairly strongly, a kid's version of News Title. The Week, aimed at the 8 to 14-year-old market, the title aims to be informative and fun at the same time. But of course, aiming at that market brings particular challenges. How to cover often very challenging issues like terrorism or climate change when you're dealing with impressionable and potentially rather fearful young minds. Well, to find out more, the Week Junior's editor, Anna Bassi, spoke to our own Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
It was actually quite a difficult one to produce for all sorts of reasons. We wanted to write about the heat wave, but we're writing for children. And of course, the heat wave, while for them has been really exciting, lots of sunshine, going to the beach. In other parts of the world, it's been quite difficult to deal with. And as we were creating last week's issue, the wildfires in Greece caused just absolute devastation. So we had to really think carefully about how to strike the balance between the fun side of hot summers and actually the serious nature of that. Wildfires, global warming, and all the rest of it. And actually, we ended up picking that particular picture because we did want it to look fun. One of the challenges we face with a magazine every week is making sure that whatever we're writing about and however serious it is, and often it can be quite serious, that we don't make our readers feel unduly anxious about anything. And obviously a front cover has to be bright and appealing anyway. So we found a way of having a fun image on the cover. It actually shows some kids in Tokyo cooling off in some water fountains because there's been a heat wave there as well. But the words that we used on the covers communicated the slightly more serious side of things. So this is all about, this looks like they're having loads of fun, and they are, and it's great, but actually it's not all fun in the sun, and this is why.
And I would like to ask you, tell us a bit more about the story of The Week Junior. I mean, I know The Week, which is a fantastically very successful weekly publication. When did it start?
So we launched The Week Junior in November 2015. So it's almost 3 years old now. And the idea for it actually came about a year before that. So The Week magazine's been around for about 20 years and it's incredibly successful. And my publisher realised that actually a lot of secondary schools were using The Week within schools, and a lot of sort of young teenagers were reading The Week. And actually, suddenly it seemed so obvious that there would be an appetite for something for a younger audience as well. That was how it was born. It was really just a moment of, well, there's a gap in the market. There's nothing out there that's communicating news and current affairs to kids in a way that makes sense to them. So they then set about developing The Week Junior. And this is what we came up with, something that's bright, cheery, but incredibly informative.
And what's the age range? I mean, what's your public? What do you have in mind?
It's 8 to 14, loosely. We certainly have readers as young as 7 and as old as 70, I think. Probably our core readers are somewhere between 10 and 12.
Tell us about the circulation. Of course, we know that The Week has been, you guys believe in print because people are buying more copies, especially, you know, so many things that are happening with Brexit,
yeah.
You know, the Trump election. Do you felt the same with The Week Junior?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've had a great success story, actually. So we launched in November 2015, as I said. We had fairly moderate targets for the magazine, which we completely smashed within the first year. And we now have a weekly circulation of around 60,000. We feel very strongly about print. I've always worked in print magazines. And I think there was a real appetite, especially amongst parents, who are the people who are actually buying this magazine, to get their kids away from their screens for at least some of the time. I think we've all got to the point now where we realise that screens are a big part of life, but you don't want to be on a screen all the time. And it's not always the best place to read either. If you, you know, I think that the experience of reading something on paper and that very sort of tactile experience is important, and you know, luckily we've been proved right.
And what are the challenges to write to this public? I mean, you did kind of mention this when you're covering, you know, the heat wave, because you wanted something fun and light, but at the same time, you know, showcasing that there's been some problems with the heat wave as well. I think you have to kind of be extra careful as well, right?
We have to be super careful. I mean, the first thing for us is actually when we decide which stories we'll cover in the magazine, and you know, we'll write about almost anything from the most serious stories. Obviously, over the past couple of years, we've had to write several stories about terrorist attacks, which has been, you know, incredibly difficult. And in fact, our first issue, unfortunately, coincided with the attacks in Paris. So, you know, within our first week, we were thrown into the situation of having to decide how we tell this story to a child. And I think the first thing for us is always, and it doesn't matter what the subject is, actually, it's always figuring out what questions they might have and how best to answer them, and how best to answer them honestly, but without giving them so much information that they don't know what to do with it, making sure they aren't left with unanswered questions that could lead them to feel more concerned. So we work very hard to sort of think about our wording very carefully. We always try and provide context to our stories because, you know, you can't assume that a child will understand the background to the civil war in Syria or to understand global warming, for example, when we're writing about heat waves. So we always provide context. We always answer questions. We avoid going into any more detail than we have to. And we always try and offer some sort of positive takeout. So, you know, there will always be a silver lining in there somewhere for somebody. It can be challenging.
Do the kids sometimes visit the office, or do you have some kind of test groups, you know, just to check whether they're interested?
Yeah, we do have kids coming into the office. We actually have a reader panel, so we occasionally ask them for their opinions about things. We actually use a social media app called PopJam, which you may or may not have heard of. It's like a kind of like an Instagram for under 13, so it's very well moderated and it's very safe space, and we can use that to communicate with our readers. We can ask them questions and pitch out debate ideas and get their opinions and things. I'm also quite lucky in that I have two children of my own who are perfectly within our target age range. I've got a 9-year-old and a 12-year-old. So between them and their friends, I have a pretty good idea about what's going on in the playground, what they're interested in, what they understand and what they want to know about.
And it's amazing what you're doing as well, because, you know, when kids from 8 to 14 are starting to read this, probably when they become adults, they will keep reading print in a way. I think that's the kind of, I mean, don't you feel that your role is very relevant for the next generation of readers?
I hope so. And again, another of the things that we thought about when we launched the magazine was how do we make this really accessible to a wide range of children? Because obviously that's quite a big age difference actually between 8 and 14 in terms of ability to read and interest and so on. So the magazine's been designed in such a way that reading is a very easy thing to do. It's very easy to navigate. It's not like other children's magazines that are designed with a sort of, they're all about fun and colour, but sometimes that actually can prevent a child from reading it properly. So it's all about reading. It's all about being accessible. Yeah, I hope that we do inspire a generation of children to go on to be adult readers.
And listen, I'm just looking here at the cover. I would buy this magazine. How to Tell If a Horse is Happy. I'm genuinely curious. You know,
so. It's all in the snorks.
Yeah, obviously. That's perfect. And also I have here Science and Nature. Tell us a bit more. It's a new project that you guys are doing.
Yeah, so Science and Nature is our new launch and it's very exciting. We're actually launching it as a monthly magazine in September. This has grown out of the fact that as a result of the information we've gathered from our reader survey, we understand that animals and science are two of the most popular parts of the weekly magazine. Obviously, in a weekly magazine with only two pages for science, for example, in every issue, we don't have much opportunity to explain things as well as we might like or to look at things in as much depth as we might like. So we thought we'd try out a magazine dedicated to science and nature. So we've done two spin-off special edition magazines, which have done extremely well for us. And so, yeah, really excited to say we're going to be launching that as a monthly.
That was Anna Bassi, editor of The Week Junior. And finally on the programme, we're heading to Scotland to talk about Indie Boom Saloon, a magazine that defines itself as a printed publication which democratises creativity for good. The magazine is a thing of beauty, but also delightfully unafraid of getting its hands dirty, pitching in with social projects in underprivileged areas, which it then documents on its pages. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco met the founder of Boom Saloon, Rachel Arthur, who told him more about it.
This is from our cover story, which was shot by Dawit NM, who is currently based in Virginia Beach, but actually spent the first 7 years of his life in Ethiopia. And it was just a story that it really, really struck me from when I heard it. And it was one of those ones, I don't know what happened with issue 3, but there was so much serendipity around it. So the cover image was actually the first image that I had seen of Dawit's work. And from there, we got in touch knowing very little about him whatsoever. And this incredible story unfolded where he had been born in Ethiopia and it was a very happy childhood. He speaks a lot about playing football with his friends and eating sugarcane and very, very wholesome and happy. And then moved to America to be confronted with this almost an alternate reality of how Ethiopia was viewed in the Western world and issues of poverty and AIDS and all these preconceptions were just constantly thrown at him. And he says in the feature that he became almost embarrassed to be known as the Ethiopian child. And then many years later, he went back and spent some time with his family after his mother had told him a particular story about a battle which had kind of reignited his love of his heritage, and he was photographing his family outside, and his little cousin said to him, "Don't make me look like the kids on TV," because even as a small child, he was really aware of this image that was being portrayed around the world. And Dawit says himself, you know, he felt like he has this job to do as a photographer to tell the real story of the real Ethiopia through his eyes, as he knows it from growing up there. So it was one of those images, as soon as I saw it, I was hooked. And then to hear the story behind it just was incredible and tied in really nicely with the project work we were doing as well.
Tell us more about the projects and how do they connect with the print title?
Yeah, absolutely. So BIM Saloon directly supports BIM Projects, which is the second strand of our business. So they're an ongoing series of community projects which use creativity to inspire and empower. And the stance that we take is partly based around this concept called ABCD, which is asset-based community development. And it's largely about understanding the potential and the talent within a community and nurturing that. So very much the way we always put it is that we look up to people and say, you have this incredible talent, you just need a little bit of support to take it to the next stage, as opposed to looking down on people and saying, you know, poor you, you've had a terrible history and all these things have happened in your past, you deserve a leg up. Instead, it's about celebrating and nurturing. So our first project was based in Edinburgh, where we are based. It was very much performance-led. So we worked with a range of incredible talents from North Edinburgh who had many challenging issues from their backgrounds. That was sometimes drug abuse, sometimes violence or crime. And we brought them all together. And, I mean, it was quite a crazy combination of different characters. But we said for this one night only, literally all of that past, it is just completely irrelevant for this performance showcase. It's all about your talent and your potential. And our second project, which we've just finished, was based in Glasgow. So we worked with young people dealing with forcible displacement to co-design a t-shirt line, which kind of explored the labels that society can attach to people and how that can be very detrimental. So that's why it tied in so nicely with Dawit's feature. And like I say, felt really serendipitous.
And which type of stories you aim to cover at BIM Saloon? I mean, because, you know, it does feel quite international, beautiful photography as well. Mm-hmm. So for a reader that might see this in the newsstand or want to subscribe, how would you define the stories you want to cover?
So we focus largely on the importance of the arts and creative industries. We really like to delve a bit deeper than just what's on the surface and tie them into what's going on with culture and society and economics and get a bit deeper. I mean, it's a funny one. We've often been told that we should somewhat pigeonhole ourselves, and I just refuse to do that. I can be a little bit stubborn sometimes, but I think it becomes a much more beautiful, exciting, eclectic thing when you are very much open to everything and have some kind of theme which ties us all together and this shared mission to democratize creativity and showcase the work of anyone, regardless of their background or their past. So that's one of the main things, I think, really giving creativity a grounding and making it accessible to all whilst also celebrating its importance to our lives.
How challenging it is, you know, to make a printout? I know you have the projects, but do you kind of have a business plan? How does it work? How do you get the revenue for the title? Or is it through newsstand sales, or are you planning to do subscriptions?
Yeah, so we actually have a triple-stranded business model.
That's cool.
So BIM Saloon is the print magazine, which has this mission to democratize creativity for good. It directly supports the projects, which use creativity to inspire and empower. And they are both really driven by the Boom Room, which is our creative studio. So we offer design, editorial and strategy for a range of clients around the world, which is very exciting. I am always very, very honest. In the early days, I used to throw out terms like, oh, you know, profits from print sales will drive everything else. There are very little profits from print sales. We don't do advertising. Our business model needs to have the third strand to make it viable. And I think what's really exciting about independent publications is the fact that they can be incredibly nimble and pull together all of these different strands to make a really diverse business model.
And that's it for this week's programme. Thanks to our producer, Fernando, and our editors, Sarah Miles and George McDonough. Comments, queries and all the rest welcome, as always. Drop a note to Fernando. You'll find him at fp@monocle.com. Don't forget to join us at the same time next week. Before you go, a playful little number to finish with. And of course, given we were hearing from Boom Saloon, it has Boom in the title. This is Swedish singer Firefox AK with Boom, Boom, Boom. That's The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Until next time, thanks for tuning in.